Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show for this September 13th. And as you noted, the theme song went on a little longer than usual, so that means one thing. We have a live guest in the studio. This will be my first live interview since the fabled March 2020. So, callers, if you hear anything amiss, feel free to text me. Those of you who know, know. Delighted to have in the studio this morning two really exciting guests. We're going to be speaking in just a few moments with Dick Sonnichsen about his new book, Enlightening America, and Sandy Compton is editor-publisher from Blue Creek Press. But before we get to the interview, everyone wants to know what the weather's doing because they look outside and they just see haze. That's hard to predict. You can't see cloud patterns or anything like that. So I'm here to tell you that today is going to be smoky and then hazy with a high of 77. I'm not sure the difference between the two, but there is hope tonight, a 30% chance of showers dropping down to 48. So if the smoke does clear, it'll cool off and be nice to open the windows and have a little good sleeping weather. Tomorrow, we also have a little bit of rain in the forecast, 50% chance, but it comes along with the threat of thunderstorms. Highs of 70, mid-70s, and lows of mid-40s through the week with looks like clearing skies. Let's keep our fingers crossed on that. So let's do turn our attention to our in-studio guests this morning, and welcome Dick Sonnichsen. Did I get the pronunciation right, Dick?
Yes, Dick Sonnichsen. Thanks for inviting me,
Bill. Yeah, welcome to the show. And Sandy Compton, a perennial guest.
Good morning. How are you guys today?
Yeah, welcome back.
Thanks.
So we're going to launch into this book, but before we do that, I'd like to go on for the full title. It's Enlightening America, Forgiving a New America with Political Civility, Forging a New America with Political Civility, Universal Equality, and Genuine Patriotism. A very engaging title. Dick, tell us a little bit about your background so we understand where you came to be interested in writing such a book. So tell us a little bit about yourself. You have a fascinating career.
Thanks, Bill. I was born and raised in Coeur d'Alene and went to the University of Idaho where I got a forestry degree. And then I worked in the woods for a while until I got a letter from Uncle Sam saying that he needed me for a couple of years in the Army. So I ended up spending 3 years in the counterintelligence corps in the Army. And then when I got out, I was more intrigued with investigating things than I was in working in the woods. So I applied for the FBI and was accepted and spent a 30-year career with the FBI. No regrets. I enjoyed every moment of it. And when I retired, I wanted to come back to this part of the world, and so I ended up in Sandpoint. Coeur d'Alene was getting a little too big for me, and I liked the little town, so here I am in Sandpoint, and happy to be here.
And you grew up in the general area, so you understand the cultural, political zeitgeist of not only North Idaho, but the nation from your background.
Right. In fact, I just wrote an article in The Reader, just came out last week, called Idaho Nice, which is a little microcosm of the book. The theme of the essay was, we all like it here, why can't we just get along?
Yeah.
That's the theme of the book, too.
It seems so obvious and simple. We're going to unpack it in the book. It's not as simple as it might seem. Sandy, tell us a little bit about yourself. A lot of our listeners will know things about you, but particularly of interest today, your background in writing, creating books, publishing books.
Well, let's see. One day I decided to become a writer, and then about 10 years later I decided to discover myself, and I started a publishing company. I am self-published, and I've also helped a number of other people publish books, including Mr. Sonnichsen here. I was counting them up as I was driving to town today, and I think I've got, between my books and the books that I've done for other people, I think I probably have published at least 30, maybe 35 books. I didn't quite. There's some that I had forgotten that I had to dredge out of my memory. But little ones, big ones. I've always been a subsidy publisher, and that's the arrangement that Dick and I have. I help him get his prose into a form that he finds acceptable, and then I also help him get it printed. So.
We're going to go more into publishing at the bottom end of the hour, because it's such an interesting topic and field, you know, how a writer's imagination, the product that we look at as a book really comes to life, and it's partly that act of creation from the writer, but then there's this whole process that has to be gone through.
Let me put in a quick plug here for Sandy. Lots of people are good at editing, and lots of people are good at writing, but it's a rare person who is good at both simultaneously. And Sandy, like he says, he turns my manuscripts into readable prose, and I appreciate his work. We sort of gelled here over the last 10 years, and I got the writing bump.
Nice. Well, that's a good segue. Dick, tell us about the moment that you decided, or maybe it wasn't a moment, but the arc where you became a writer.
It probably happened in graduate school. I swore I'd never go back to school after I graduated from the University of Idaho. But later on in life, my boss in the FBI said we ought to go back and get some more education. And so I fought it for about a year and then finally capitulated. University of Southern California has a satellite campus in Washington, D.C. So I went back there and started graduate school and found out that I liked it, strangely enough, and started writing then. And that sort of kicked it off. And then when I retired, I had more time on my hands, and I started writing then. And I had time to think about what was going on in the world. When you're working and raising a family, I've got three kids, and you're just so busy with the day-to-day routine that you don't really have time to sit and think about things. I don't think. Most people don't. And so once I got retired, I was concerned about what's going on. Most of my writing has been social commentary on politics and the country here and the community. So that's sort of how I got started in graduate school, Philly.
Well, take us on a little tour of the books you've written. Tell us about the collection.
Well, I started off, the first book I wrote was, my wife and I had been Catholics for all our lives. So I wrote a book on why we left the Catholic Church. It's called All Fish Have Bones. And it has to do with, we used to eat fish on Friday and couldn't eat meat in those days. And so that's the sort of the title. Then I wrote an autobiography, which is called A Leaf in the Stream. And then I wrote another one on what I predicted for the future of the church. I called it the Catholic Church, called The Church in Peril. And then I got concerned about the misogynist phenomenon that takes place in this country and has historically. And so I wrote a book called Why Don't Men Like Women? And that was fun because I had to do a lot of research because it was a field I wasn't really familiar with.
And he didn't even get in too much trouble.
Yeah. And then I wrote the book before this one that just came out. It's called Adventures in Good Living. And it was just my sense from 8 decades of life on how one could come to enjoy life and get through the travails that occur in a lifetime. So, and then this book was written. I got concerned about what's going on in the country. I think a lot of people are. We seem to be adrift from our original moorings, and politically and socially both. And so that was the impetus for the Enlightening America book.
How do all these books, they seem to fit together and through some common strings. Tell us a little about how you perceive that.
I guess the common stream would be concerned about, first of all, the existential question is why are we here and what are we supposed to do with ourselves while we're here? We have a rather short lifespan if you think about it. And we've got two critical problems that we need to face. One is politically and socially, and the other is our relationship with nature. Unfortunately, we think we're superior to the other living organisms on the planet, and we have abused and despoiled the planet, and at the rate we're going, it won't be sustainable for our children and grandchildren. So that concerns me. So I have two concerns, the social concern and the sustainability of the planet if we don't come to grips. And I don't see a lot of progress in either of those areas. I could just, let me, I could read about.
Yeah, let's start with a short reading here.
Four sentences here that gives me a little feel for, this is sort of in the introduction to the current book. America is a fragmented nation in deep disagreement with no unifying options on the horizon. We are a nation afraid. Afraid of each other, our elected officials, the direction of the country, and the destiny of the planet. The American community is perplexed, ideologically impoverished, adrift from its historical moorings, and apprehensive about the future. There is a pervasive anxiety in America that our traditional way of life may be slipping into oblivion. And that sort of sets the table for my concerns, the twofold, politically and socially, and you and Sandy are very active here in the community on the nature part. And I don't think human beings have come to grips with the idea that they're not a superior organism on the planet. They're more intelligent than all the rest, but they're not superior. And there's a nuance there that a lot of people don't understand.
There's a lot in the book. It was very fascinating to read, and you weave through an analysis of so many of the challenges that face us currently. And, you know, again, coming back to how do we collectively address those?
Yeah, I think we've got to do a couple of things. I make two or three suggestions in the book. One is I think we need to get away from political parties. The ideologies are crumbling today. The Republicans and the Democrats really don't have a coherent ideology that you can put your fingers on. I suggest that politicians ought to run independently without a party connection and say, in other words, put pragmatism in the forefront. In other words, I'm Dick Sonickson, I'm running for governor of Idaho, and this is what I'm going to do, and keep it on a pragmatic basis. I also suggest in the book there that one of the things that we have is a problem of education. And I'm suggesting that we have a two-year mandatory commitment, obligatory commitment, for everybody between the ages of 18 and 28 to serve our country for 2 years. And during that time, they would learn a trade or a profession and then serve the community. And I think that would come a long way from getting away from the racial divisiveness that we see in this country, and also educate people and increase the employment content. So they're rather severe suggestions, and I'm not so naive to think they're going to be easily implemented, but I think the solutions are there if we just want to, the solution is there if we want to take the step.
Dick calls this the Patriot Corps, and I actually think it's one of the best ideas that he has in the book. And it's not military service, although we have talked about this. The idea is that they would have military training and then branch off into other areas of interest, and they would have choices to make about what they want to learn about, and even maybe where they want to serve. So it wouldn't be like the Army all the time, but they would get combat training and become part of the National Guard or some similar organization. Mm-hmm. But then they would get education about crafts, skills, scholastic type stuff, but practical stuff about what they're going to do with their life when they get out of this place. And also, it's a great idea as far as I'm not going to call it homogenization, but it's a good idea about how to learn about other people, how to experience other cultures, because you're going to be if this was ever to happen, a lot of different kinds of people would be put into this situation, and they would learn from each other about how to get along, about maybe even good things to eat, fun things to do. I think it's a great idea, and I don't know that it'll ever happen, but it would be great for our country if it did, I think.
It's seems like we have some steps in that direction. We had some steps in that direction with the creation of the Peace Corps and then the VISTA volunteers. And it almost sounds like taking those and refocusing them would be one approach.
Right.
Yeah, that's the idea. The obligatory part is going to be the difficult part. But I think those of us who enjoy living in this country, there ought to be some reciprocity. Mm-hmm. A little give back for the what we enjoy. We've got a great country, and we need to all participate. And the idea, Sandy mentioned it too, I think the racial divisiveness that we have in this country could be solved by putting all these people together and learning that they're basically, we don't have that much difference other than skin color. We're all the same DNA, and this would go a long way. And people would be educated. They'd spend I'm suggesting three months of military training, and then 9 months where you would learn a skill. You'd learn to weld or be a carpenter, or if you were a nurse, or and so you would come out of there with a profession or a trade, and then you would get paid for that. And then when you finally ended up with your 2 years, you could go off, and our unemployment would drop considerably.
So how do we get there? Where does the campaign start?
Well, it has to start with the politicians, and I'm not optimistic with the current state of politics in this country that we're going to get anything off. Mm-hmm. You and Sandy have been working on Scotchman's Peak. You understand the difficulty in trying to get something through Congress. Other than passing funding bills right now, they're not doing anything at all.
Yeah, change does come slowly. What do you hope people who pick up the book will take away from it as to how it touches them and their lives and what they do with it?
I think it shows that there is a way to live congenially in this country with each other. If we just use common sense, I think pragmatism would be the word. I would take some of the ideologies and the divisiveness that's going on now, I think could be ameliorated a little bit by sitting down and taking a pragmatic, in other words, look at a problem and then look at the solution, and not try and solve it with science and reason. Basically, the book is saying, let's use science and reason to address problems and get away from all the other extraneous ideologies and beliefs that tend to clutter up progress.
Dick, is death on dogma. and it's really good to have those thoughts expressed. We often fall into these beliefs that are sourced in other things than logic, and I call it willful ignorance. And I'm not sure if I got that term from him or not, but sometimes it seems like people just don't want to know. They don't want to think about it. But if we don't start doing that, and that's Dick's point, if we don't start doing that, we're going to be in even deeper stuff than we are now. Mm-hmm. We've got to start approaching the world in a logical and scientific manner, because that's really the only way that we're going to find the solutions that we need to keep going as a species. I always felt that it wasn't up to us to save the world. It was up to us to save ourselves, because the world is going to take care of itself. The planet's going to be here for a long time after we're gone if we don't watch what we're doing.
Sandy mentioned the science. We have an unfortunate situation. I think science is the answer for getting out of some of these messes that we're in. But the scientific community has to decide how they can communicate with the general population in lay terms that are understood. And the and the population has to trust science. So it's a two-way street. The scientists are not very good at disseminating complex scientific information in a understandable way. We have an anti-science basis and bias in this country. We have an intellectual bias in this country, which impedes progress. So if we can get the scientific community to understand a little bit more about how to communicate, and then we can educate the public a little bit more in science, and that would go a long way. Because Sandy alluded to, human beings are not necessarily going to be here forever. The bugs will be here. We're going to have the bugs are still going to live here. They were here before us, and they're going to be here after us. If we want to leave the planet to our children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren, we need to start seriously contemplating solutions to some of these problems with nature.
Maybe you should write another book called Human Survival for Dummies.
Or for cockroaches. Yeah. You know, it is an interesting problem that the communication of scientific ideas, their acceptance, their rejection, it's as old as Galileo, literally, and yeah. We've been struggling with this culturally, not just in America, but I think in all Western culture for the last several hundred years. How do we change that?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm hesitant to tread into the religious area, but I'll take one little short step in there. I think we need to come to grips with science versus religion. And religion is I have no problems with anybody's beliefs, but I think they should be personal and not be part and parcel of either the scientific community or the political community, and that would help to some degree to accept science and maybe get away from a little bit from mythology.
The book was published earlier this year. I don't have the exact date at my fingertips. I think it first came on my radar in June, so it was probably just before that. It's been a busy summer. Congress has actually passed some fairly substantial legislation addressing whether you think it's overreach or underreach, climate change and infrastructure and defense in the form of propping up a homegrown microchip industry, one of the weakest links. And do you see some signs of hope and progress there?
I think so. It's still strange to me that Congress can't get together and identify a problem and then solve it. But the American public has a part to play too, and that's voting. There's an apathy among the general population when it comes to voting that really needs to be overcome. We have the power to vote politicians out of office who are feckless and don't solve problems, but we don't do that. The vote is a powerful tool for the American public to end up getting a Congress that they want. It's efficient and rational and productive. So we're going to have to, some way, get people to get off the sofa and out in front of the television set and go to the polls and vote.
I think that's a great segue. Get out and vote this fall. The election's coming up. It's only about 6 weeks away, 7 weeks away now, and that's probably a really good note to end the first half of this interview on. We're going to take a short music break, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit about the intersect of this book and the publishing industry with our guests here, Dick Sonicson and Sandy Compton. Dick has just recently released his latest book, Enlightening America, Forging a New America with Political Civility, Universal Equality, and Genuine Patriotism. Sandy Compton, publisher of Blue Creek Press, has brought it to life. And as I said, we're going to take a short interlude here with a song by War. War, Why Can't We Be Friends? One of the central themes of Dick Sonnichsen's new book. If you're just tuning in, this is the KRFY Morning Show with your host, Phil Huff, Tuesday, September 13th. We're talking with author Dick Sonnichsen, Enlightening America, Forging a New American, a New America with Political Civility, Universal Equality, and Genuine Patriotism. Along with Dick in the studio here is Sandy Compton, publisher of Blue Creek Press. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'd like to focus a little bit on this segment about the intersect of an author and a publisher and how that brings a book to life. It really takes both efforts and talents. Blue Creek Press has published a number of your books, Dick. Tell us how you got started with Sandy.
You know, it's fuzzy. Maybe he remembers better than I do.
We met at SWAC.
I think we did.
Yeah, in the locker room.
For the new locals, SWAC is...
Well, now YMCA.
But it was the gym. We were gym rats together.
Yeah.
And I was looking... I had started writing without any idea of publishing. And so I asked around, and Sandy had already had a reputation here for being a writer, and then I found out later that he had Blue Creek Press, and so we got to chatting, and he agreed to read my stuff and see if it was any good, and so I don't know if he thinks it's any good or not, but he's at least...
It's pretty good, Dick. It's pretty good.
He at least has agreed to publish. I've written, I think, 6 books with him, and I've got another one coming out pretty soon. I'm just finishing up polishing now. So we got started, and it turns into a friendship. Like I mentioned earlier, I want to plug him again. He writes and he edits both at a very skilled level. And writing is a solitary event. You sit there all by yourself with a sheet of paper or a computer, in this case, and you get myopic after a while, and so you need someone else to read it and say, "Boy, that's really stupid what you said on page 12." And so Sandy does that, and he edits. He uses Word, and so the word processor is really good because he can send stuff back to me with the original that I have and then what he's suggesting. So I have a comparison, and the software that he uses is. It's fantastic.
We play word tennis. he sends me something. I make changes. I send it back to him, and then he generally we're pretty good. We came to an agreement early on about how to process things, and we've used that method all the way through. I don't cut his work a lot, but I do move things around, and so that they make more sense as far as flow goes, and it gives him the opportunity to say what he wants to say, and then it gives me the opportunity to clarify that for the reader. It's a good arrangement. I've enjoyed working with Dick a lot, and as he has often reminded me, he keeps Blue Creek Press in business. and now he's taken a giant step in his next book. You want to tell him about that?
Yeah, tell us about your next project.
Well, I thought I'd try fiction. I enjoy writing. I'd probably write even if Sandy wouldn't publish stuff. I'd have to find somebody else. But I've decided to try a fiction book, and so I placed this back in the 60s and starts in Coeur d'Alene, where a fellow there robs a bank. And then after he gets out of prison, he moves to Sandpoint and gets involved. It's rather intricate involvement of about a half a dozen people. But I found it fascinating and difficult to write. I'll never again put one back that far. I thought 1960 was just recent, but it turns out that it was quite a while ago, and my memory isn't serving me very well, so I had to be careful writing, that I wasn't using cell phones, and went to the museum in Coeur d'Alene, and took a picture. You saw a picture of the bank there, but they had a bunch of old cars parked out in front of it. And I wondered why all those old cars are out there. And then it occurs to me that they weren't old cars in those days. They were. That was the state of the art. So we'll see when Sandy gets this. This is going to be a challenge for his editing skills.
I'm looking forward to it.
It's a sort of a, it's not violent, but it's got some, a little bit of violence, a little bit of romance, a little bit of everything.
Could stretch into a new direction, but still explore that human condition. So
yes, it has to do with the interfacing of five or six people.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to working on this book, and I'm thinking that Dick's time as a FBI special agent probably is going to add a lot of intrigue to this product. That'll be good.
It'll lend a lot of authenticity.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's one of the protagonists in the book is the bank robber, obviously, but then he gets arrested by the FBI agent. I had to get the FBI in there somewhere. So that's they're at odds, and that's one of the themes in the book. So I think it was fun to write. The other books I've written had a lot of research and a lot of reading to do. When you're writing fiction, you just use your imagination, so you just have to turn your head on, which is difficult in some cases and not so difficult in others. But it's fun, and I think I'm going to try, depending on what Sandy's opinion on this book is, I might try another one. I've got a little idea, an outline for another one.
That's one thing I wanted to mention. Dick is an incredible researcher. His bibliographies are as long as some of his chapters. And he is a voracious reader and also real good at taking these things that he finds out and weaving them into his tales. I admire him for that.
Yeah, I always admire long bibliographies like this one, and it's really fascinating to see which books went into your thinking, Dick, and as a reader looking at it going, wow, that's a lot of books to read just to bring another book to bear. But,
yeah, it's, you know, you probably read the 50 or 60 books to get the background for one. But I enjoy that. It's fun. Like I said, it keeps me occupied, not on my wife's hair, mm-hmm. not at the local bars. you know, one of the things you mentioned, Phil, about the publishing thing, I think the things that's allowed delusional writers like myself to publish now is the idea of the on-demand printing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can order one of my books from Amazon, and they'll print one copy and send it to you for $3 or $4. So anybody can do that, and the publisher's not out. He doesn't have to have an inventory.
No.
Nor do I have to have an inventory. I'm reminded of Henry David Thoreau, one of my favorite writers. He said, "I have a library of 1,000 books, 999 of them which I wrote myself." So in the old days, you had to get a publisher who would print a certain number of books to make it financially viable. But now you can print just one book or two books, and that's gone a long way for people like me who write.
Yeah, that's a great opportunity here to turn Sandy to you and explore the world of publishing. I think for many folks listening, they may think that a publisher is a printing house, and it's not the same thing, never has been, and it's changed. So tell us just a little bit about the publishing world and the changes you've seen.
Well, for years and years, decades, centuries, actually, publishers and printing houses were often owned by the same people, but they are not the same thing. A printing house is a physical plant where books are put together, collated, bound, and then put in boxes, or in the case of on-demand printing, mailed off to the person who just ordered them. William Randolph Hearst, he was one of the biggest publishers in America, 28 major newspapers. he also owned printing presses. But as time has gone on and the computer revolution has affected the way things work, on-demand printing has changed the world of publishing, if you will. The publisher is the guy or person or the company that takes the information and turns it into a form which can be printed through editing, design, through acquisition, if they're interested in being proprietary. But they take the manuscript, the pictures, all of the materials that make the book up, and turn it into a form that can be printed. And then the printing house prints the book. When I first started, Blue Creek Press actually is almost 20 years old now, but when I first started in the printing business, well, in the book business, it was the only way that you could viably print a book would be to pay for at least 1,000 copies. That was the only way that you could make any money on it. I shouldn't say that, because the first book I ever printed was 500 copies, but we sold all of them, so okay. it was printed by the Daily Bee, as a matter of fact. But we sold all of those. But since that time, well, I'll just give you an example. When I worked for Multilingual Magazine, I was a production manager, and when I first went to work for them, it took me and a couple other people 2 days to put everything together that had to be shipped off to the printer. And the printer was a company, and still is, I believe, a magazine printing company over on the East Coast. But you would send them computer files, but you'd also send them the pictures, you would send them the layout, you would send them all of this stuff in a big box, shipped off UPS next day. And then by the time I retired from that business and went to work for Friends of Scotch and Peaks, it took me about 4 hours myself to put together everything that we needed to put together onto a SyQuest drive, or actually later on it was just like we were actually uploading files directly across the internet to the printer, who fed those files right into the press. There was no intermediary. You were not doing any mock-ups. You weren't doing any layouts. You took all of these files and you just directly put them into the press, and out came a magazine. And that revolution has also moved into the printing, the book printing industry. The first time I worked with on-demand printing was when I was still working for Multilingual as well. There was a company, I can't even think of the name, createspace.com. And they specialized in taking your manuscript, your cover, upload them as a PDF file, and printing a book. They would print one, they would print 100, no price difference, no price breaks for bulk. But it made the printing end of the publishing business a lot more affordable for a lot more people. Dick's book, Lightning America, I think our retail on it is, what, $14.95? But the printing cost on it is like $3.50. So you can order one, you can order 10, you can order 100, and you're going to pay $3.50, $35, or $3,500. But the beauty of it is that you don't have to order 1,000 books anymore. This has been good and bad. A lot of very talented people have been able to more affordably move their books from concept into reality. And a lot of very untalented people have also been allowed to do that. So it's a two-edged sword.